How did you come to form your identity as a libertarian? What is it that you perhaps don't particularly align yourself with when it comes to the ideologies of the Republican and the Democratic parties?
Well, I've actually been both previously in my life, and I'm a strong believer in the Constitution, and I kind of found that the Republicans like parts of it and not others, and that the Democrats like parts of it and not others. And I'm kind of a person who thinks that the Constitution needs to be get your arms around it as one thing and not pick and choose. So you have a Constitution Party, and you also have a Libertarian Party. The Constitution Party certainly is focused on that, but also is a little more to the right. Libertarians tend to believe that as long as you're not doing harm to someone else, that the Constitution means that you should be free to live your life as you choose to, and not as the state tells you to.
In a news press profile I'd written or written or not I'd read on you rather, they had said that you've kind of characterized libertarians into two different camps. There's the anarchist libertarian and the limited government libertarian. Where on that spectrum do you fall and why?
Yeah, that's a big sliding scale. And on the far right, there are the folks that don't want any government schools and even hate government roads. And to me, that's just not practical. I mean, if you live on an island with five people, maybe you can have anarchy. But an organized society of 330 million plus people, I'm more of a small government guy. I believe government is a necessary evil. The bottom line is that it can be evil, and that's what we really have right now.
Well, we'll get into that a little bit later, but first I wanted to talk about your background before running for office. You had a long, successful career in the armed services before retiring for the Air Force in 1995. Tell us about some of the positions and responsibilities you've held throughout all those years and how you think those experiences could translate into helping you prepare to represent the constituents of Florida's 19th Congressional District.
Okay, well, I graduated from high school when I was 17, and I wanted to be a policeman. And the only place that at the age of 17 gives you a badge and a gun is the U.S. military. So when I was 17 days, I raised my hand, went in, and started out in law enforcement, became a cost management analyst later on after getting an undergraduate degree in management from the University of New Hampshire. And about the 8.5 year point, I received a direct appointment commission in the Medical Service Administrative Corps of the U.S. Air Force Medical Service. So for the next 12 years, I essentially did healthcare and hospital administration in clinics, hospitals, everything from resource management, logistics, personnel. And then when I retired, I was actually doing planning on a regional basis for what's called TRICARE, Department of Defense Region 1. And interestingly enough, it actually ties into the Affordable Care Act, and what we see right now in the VA is that my job was to go out, look at all the healthcare facilities, see what their in-house capabilities were, and then figure out what we needed to contract for to fill that delta. Let's take the VA. They have a real problem and a backlog right now in scheduling. There should be standards. A non-urgent appointment within 30 days, let's say for optometry, an urgent appointment within 5 days, something emergent same day or next day. And then if they don't have the in-house capacity to do that, they either need to do a physician-provider network. Or it's something that I think they're finally talking about after years and years is even a voucher program where they can say, here, you go find the care, we'll pay for it. And at least that way the vet has some say in it and can do something other than just sit there and believe that they're on a waiting list and going to get through the door.
And given your extensive experience in the healthcare industry, and last year's rollout of the Affordable Care Act, I wanted to get your thoughts on that. Are there places where the ACA has gotten it right and places where they've gotten it wrong? How would you like to see that dealt with or possibly changed?
Yeah. Well, We'll go back to what being a libertarian is all about. Being a libertarian means that the federal government isn't responsible for your health care. The notion that there's an individual mandate on a 5-4 Supreme Court decision, which I believe was politically aligned, I still believe it's unconstitutional. I don't care what John Roberts says. The notion that one side argues it's a fee, it's a fee, it's a fee, and then magically it becomes a tax. To me, that sets off alarm bells. So first and foremost, I believe that the Affordable Care Act is unconstitutional. Having said that, it right now is the law, and we've seen its rollout as a comprehensive bill or law, and anytime you have a federal government comprehensive anything, there are all sorts of unintended consequences. And we've seen that with folks getting kicked off of their health plans after being told they can keep them, no longer being able to see their doctors after they were told they can continue to see their doctors. So this is the result of federal government meddling. I want to see the government out of education, out of healthcare. We have 50 states, we have 50 governors, we have all sorts of municipalities within those states. They're really there to take and assist us in our daily lives, not Washington, D.C., with 535 little anointed people who believe that they know what's best for us.
And your Republican opponent, Kirk Clawson, has called for repealing of the Affordable Care Act. Is that something else that you would like to see? And do you think even doing so would be something of an uphill challenge, given how many, I think there's like 8 million people who have already signed up so far?
Yeah. Well, Kurt quite often means well. Absent getting a supermajority in the Senate and also a veto-proof House, that's delusional Republican sound bites to say we're going to repeal Obamacare. It just wouldn't happen because Mr. Obama would never approve it. The sad part is we had a good, viable, working health care system. My contention is it was the best in the world. And now we've essentially broken it. And we have an administration that picks and chooses portions of a law which in theory it should simply roll out and enforce, and it hasn't. So we have the individual mandate pushed back. We have an employer mandate pushed back. And to me, that I find disturbing. So what we really needed was a primary care insurance type of function, almost like Medicare, that state governors could take folks who had no health insurance and perhaps get them some type of medical coverage so that they don't wind up using emergency rooms as primary care clinics. That was the problem. And instead of addressing a problem for 7 million people, we broke something for 70 million people. So again, Washington, D.C. overreach, bad for the nation.
Well, let's talk about your platform on fiscal issues. Would you support Congress having to pass a balanced budget each year, just as state lawmakers here in Florida are constitutionally required to do?
I believe the representative votes aye. Yes, I would be pushing the green button. The notion that the federal government collects $2 to $3 trillion a year and can't live within that boundary, I find offensive. We've become an entitlement nation. And we can't continue to have a $17.5 trillion sinkhole growing ever larger. The interest on the debt is growing ever larger and is actually, it hurts employment, it hurts taxpayers. So D.C. is out of control. And I know that going there, if I get sent by the voters of this district, that it's going to require 100 pounds of effort to wind up with an ounce of change. I understand that. But it has to start somewhere. And the Republicans aren't doing it, and the Democrats aren't doing it, and there's no libertarian in Congress that helped create the sinkhole that we have. So I'm going to try to go and stick my finger in the dike.
All right. Well, let's talk about the you know, the issue of raising the debt ceiling. On your website, you say that you would never vote to do that. As I understand it, raising the debt ceiling doesn't really authorize new government spending. It allows us to pay debt on money we've already spent. So why would you take that position?
I take that position, and the position that I've taken is also like the balanced budget, is that absent being in a declared state of war, Congress actually doing that, not the president at whim saying we're going to go interfere somewhere around the globe, continuing to raise the debt ceiling, we've actually enabled Congress to continue to run out of control deficits. And I think that that has to be the first line. Either a balanced budget needs to be the first line, or no more continual raising of the debt ceiling. Again, if we're getting $3 trillion a year into the coffers and can't manage the federal government on that, then I think the federal government's too big. And as long as we continue to raise the debt ceiling, it's going to continue to grow to be too big.
Okay. And let's take a look at taxes. I know there's some reforms you'd like to see made to the tax code. Tell us about what you'd like to see happen.
Okay. Well, I believe that if we can't change the system, if we can't go to a fair tax, flat tax, VAT-oriented approach, that we need to at least press down the tax rates. Everyone sort of has to have some skin in the game. Corporate deductions and loopholes and individual deductions and loopholes. I think we have not necessarily a tax code itself, but if you take all the regulations, all the guidelines, apparently it's 70,000 pages, which we divide by 500. How many reams of paper and trees is that? No single person can understand the U.S. tax code. That includes the former Secretary of the Treasury, who doesn't know how to pay his taxes. And then you have even the designers of the bill who have bungalows down in the Dominican Republic and, oops, forget to declare their rental income. So we have such a complex tax code. My personal belief is that the federal government right now knows what you earn via your W-2s, via your 1099s. They've now even gotten into tax-free issues for the last 3 or 4 years. You've had to declare that. Essentially, the federal government knows virtually, probably with 99% accuracy, because that's what they bump up against your submitted return, what it is each person, each corporation has more or less made. So I think it needs to be reversed, that once a year you get in the mail a one-page, two-page statement that says, here's your federal tax bill, and it shows everything on it, and you look at it and you say either, yes, that's correct, sign it and you're done, or if you have an exception, you attach the exception, send it in, and then it's done. But the notion that I've spent 5 to 7 hours on TurboTax for what should be a relatively simple return, or that someone that is doing like a Schedule A has to go to H&R Block folks will hate me for this, but the notion that we have to pay to do a relatively simple tax form again tells me that it's out of control. It's broken.
And let's turn to the subject of term limits, which is something I know you support. Even just here locally, Lee County commissioners are taking steps to actually put that issue towards the voters in a referendum in November. I know the school board members have also looked into that as well. And I think we're the only municipality in the state that's taking steps like that, which is kind of interesting. But why would you support term limits for federal lawmakers?
Well, we have essentially careerists right now in D.C., a whole bunch of them. The notion that you've been there for 20, 30, 40 years, when my wife and I look at the evening news sometimes, we say, that guy was there when we were in high school. And I think with that longevity, certainly you get a little bit of expertise, but you also get some pretty inflated egos and folks who I think get out of touch with actually what's going on, whether it's buying arugula in the supermarket, whether it's figuring out that there are scanning codes on products as you go through the line, that if you're out of touch for so long, then how can you possibly relate to the issues that folks go through day by day? So I think that a 3-4 term limit for a representative, 1 or 2 for a senator, I think that's what the founders would have intended. I don't think that the intention was to have professional, careerist politicians sitting in D.C., feathering their own nests while they do it. I think it's always interesting to see what someone enters Congress with in terms of personal net worth and what they leave Congress with. So I would love to see term limits, and that would be something that I would try to caucus with someone to try to get something passed.
And generally, I know you support this idea of a more constitutionally constrained government, and I think aspects of that have come up throughout our conversation this morning. But maybe more generally, what do you mean by that?
Well, we are still in, and I'll take heat because it's grandstanding on America. But I truly believe I've traveled around the globe. There are many great places to be, but this is the place where folks still want to try to go, to live, to be free. And what's got us to that point is this document that someone in Washington happens to think is antiquated. I don't think it's antiquated. I think it's a very great set of guidelines that has let us get to where we are today. The most generous, the most powerful nation in the world. And we've slipped. We've kind of lost our path. And if we focus a little bit more on the Constitution and not trying to control what we say, what we eat, who we live with, how we live our lives, what we plug into our ceilings and light bulbs, decisions can be made by the markets, by people. It doesn't require the government to tell us how to live our lives.
And I think we're all aware of this culture of political gridlock that's, you know, really permeated our country's politics pretty intensely in recent years. Do you think that as a libertarian that your political identity could be a challenge, or do you think that there's some opportunities there for you to work with folks across the aisle?
Yeah. Well, this is a question that has come up over the last year, and I've actually been on this campaign trail now since May of last year. Who will I caucus with, and how do I think that would work? And I think it's I won't say ironic, but you have this divide, the right versus the left. So when you hear a politician saying, oh, I will reach across the aisle, that tells you something, that there is this division. And libertarians actually are down the center. I straddle both sides. So there's no reaching across. If anything, there's just reaching down or out or up. But we, as libertarians, there are things in both parties that we agree with. Whether I'm Republican light or Democrat heavy, I'm not sure what the term would be. But I envision that on fiscal issues that a Mr. Boehner, a Mr. Gowdy would approach me and say, I think we have your vote on this. And if there's something a little more left, a little more social, that hopefully a Pelosi follow-on would come up to me and say, Ray, can we expect your vote on this? So the bottom line for voters who would send me is that if it's within the confines of the Constitution, I'm probably going to vote yes. If it's not within the confines of the Constitution, I'm probably going to vote no. So if they're not political animals, if they're not following everything that goes on in Washington, if they send me, that's what they should know. If they're sending Clausen or Freeman, then they have to worry about what the party wants them to do. And with me, that's not the case.
And final question for you. You know, in regards to the predecessor who held this position, Trey Radle, you know, despite issues that led to his resignation, in the months that he was in Congress, he was known for, you know, staying in touch with constituents via social media, taking lots of trips down here, holding town hall meetings, really talking to constituents. And in contrast, we do have lawmakers in Washington who tend to stay in Washington and don't spend a lot of time in their district. How do you see yourself maybe dividing your time between Washington and your constituent district?
Well, I believe that constituency services is really what it's all about, is because of the multiple layers of bureaucracy that sometimes what a representative, and it's usually representatives that get tasked with it, is to try to find a way in by going to the agency head or the congressional liaison staff within all of the different agencies and departments, and trying to work individual issues that don't fall within the 99% of what bureaucracies usually do. And that's what I actually worked on. I usually surf out in the 1% that when there are problems and people need attention on special things, that's what I've always done in my life. So for me, constituency services is something that I would easily identify with. I've worked with inspector generals. I've worked with congressional staff. So it's ironic that we find ourselves in this special election with Mr. Radl, because I had hoped that that's who I would be running against. And as a libertarian, his departure is even more disturbing, because he didn't hurt anyone. He didn't run through the halls naked and swinging from chandeliers. If you listen to the first report, he was doing it to stay up to read the Affordable Care Act at night. So one person's caffeine or one person's tequila, apparently in the halls of Congress, if you gave folks breathalyzers all the time, you might be surprised there too, that everyone should be free to lead their own life. Had Mr. Radl not done an adequate job, and from all appearances he had, then I would say that there was an impairment from that. And then that would be a medical issue. The notion that we have this war on, this trillion-dollar, 40-year war on drugs that has destroyed people's lives, we've incarcerated millions of people, and in this case, we have an empty House seat over that issue, I think we can do better than that. And I don't think that that's what the founding fathers thought of. Back then, cocaine, marijuana, whatever was out there that God put in plants, is something that everyone did. It was medicinal, it was recreational, and we've, for some odd reason, turned way away from that.
Well, Ray Netherwood, thanks so much for speaking with us this morning.
Okay, well, thank you for having me.